1-877-KPFK-8288. That's 1-877-KPFK-AUTO to learn more.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake.
Yes presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. This week, I'll be out of town for a writer's residency. And I'm bringing back some interviews from the Rising Up archives, specifically interviews with abolitionists. First, we'll hear from Professor Malina Abdullah of California State University in Los Angeles, who's a leader in Black Lives Matter LA, and we'll have a conversation about how participatory budgeting can lead toward divestment from policing. Then food justice activist Leah Penniman joins me for an in-depth conversation linking our environment with the abolition of police and prisons. Finally, we'll hear a conversation with Gina Dent, abolitionist feminist at UC Santa Cruz. All three interviews are featured in my latest book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, just published by Seven Stories Press. That's coming up in just a moment. And for Los Angeles audiences, I'll be doing a book talk on Saturday, May 17th at the Buena Vista Park Library in Burbank at 2 p.m. And I hope to see you there. Yes presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Malina Abdullah is a fixture among racial justice activists in Los Angeles, California, leading Black Lives Matter LA protests and actions from the campus of Cal State LA, where she's a professor. In 2024, she became Cornel West's choice of vice president for his independent presidential run. As an outspoken abolitionist of policing and prisons, Abdullah has championed defunding the police using a concrete, practical, and deeply democratic method of participatory budgeting, where city residents decide how their tax dollars should be spent. In a conversation that I had with her last year, Abdullah pointed out how BLMLA was poised to prove that defunding and abolishing police were not impossible. I'm so pleased today to share this conversation with you for the first time. It's one of 12 interviews featured in a new book of conversations conducted for this show called Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, published by Seven Stories Press with a foreword by Robin D.G. Kelly and officially released on January 14th, 2025. Welcome to the program, Malina.
Thank you, Sonali.
So let's first get into the idea of what participatory budgeting is. Can you give our audience a sense of where the idea came from? And was it always a tool as a pathway toward reimagining public safety?
So some people think that we came up with participatory budgeting, that Black Lives Matter, it's some new thing that was developed in order to defund the police. We do want participatory budgeting to be used to defund the police. But the concept of participatory budgeting goes back many, many decades. It's a very deeply rooted concept in the overall concept of democracy. When you talk about participatory budgeting, you're talking about people having an investment in where their tax dollars are spent, people having a stake in where their tax dollars are spent. And so rather than having policymakers or electeds determine without any public input where the dollars go, people actually have a say-so and a voice and where the dollars go. We know that without the voice of the people, special interests, and by special interests, I mean lobby groups like police associations, which are not unions, but have wield tremendous power. I mean, even things like defense contractors tend to influence both local and state and federal budgets in ways that spend an exorbitant amount, often the lion's share of the budget, on policing and militarism.
So how has this process been applied toward defunding police in Los Angeles in particular?
Sure. So in 2020, when the COVID pandemic first hit Los Angeles, we started looking around and said, why are they still spending upwards of 50% of the city's general fund on police? Nobody's even outside. What we need is resources for so people can stay in their homes. We need resources for mental health. I mean, we're still seeing the mental health impact of the COVID crisis, right? We need resources for public health in the midst of the worst public health crisis in global history. That's where our funds should be going. But instead, they continue to spend upwards of 50% of the city's general fund on police. And so we said we should be spending money on services, not police. And so got into conversation, called together. We convened a meeting with virtually every Black organization in Greater Los Angeles. And we all agreed that we wanted to fund services, not police, and decided that let's collect the voices. If we as organizers feel this way, what does Black Los Angeles feel? And so we launched the People's Budget Survey. We had a series of conversations. And what came back with that initial finding is people wanted to spend money on mental health and housing as their two top priorities. And their lowest level of spending, in fact, the area that they wanted to cut funding to, was police and traffic enforcement, which also makes sense, right? So that's what they wanted. And then that only intensified in May when we saw the murder, the state-sanctioned lynching of George Floyd, and the whole world kind of went into an uproar. So we had almost 3 months of data, 2 to 3 months of data before the murder of George Floyd. And then after May, they wanted to defund the police even further. And so that's when you saw defund the police become a clarion call, where cities all over the country were saying defund the police and dismantle police departments. In fact, again, abolish police became not something that was seen as just kind of this fringe call, but something that people started asking questions about. What would police abolition look like? What would new systems of public safety look like? And that's what the People's Budget sought to amplify. Since 2020, we've done that survey every single year. We've done town hall meetings and workshops and work groups and focus groups to try to figure out how we can get to where most people want to be, and most intensely Black women want to move away from oppressive models of policing and towards kind of this resource rich community focused system of public safety.
So this process began before the racial reckoning of 2020, which is remarkable. It didn't come out of the protests and the mass uprising in summer of 2020. It may have been amplified by those. It started before, as you said, the murder of George Floyd. You presented the findings and the survey results and the results of this participatory budgeting process to former Mayor Eric Garcetti. How have the people's budgets been received by elected officials, by the mayor, by the city council?
So former Mayor Eric Garcetti refused to receive the people's budget presentation. We were able to present it to city council because then city council president Herb Wesson invited us to present it to city council. So in 2020, one of the things that we believe probably cost Herb Wesson his next seat is a complete kind of turn in how he viewed public safety. One of the most famous quotes of his at that time was, "I won't always be an elected official, but I'll always be a Black man, a Black father, and a Black grandfather. And so I have to move from that space." And so as he ran for his next seat, he actually rejected the endorsement of the Police Protective League and the Association of Los Angeles Deputy Sheriff, or sent it back, said, "I don't want it anymore." And we think that probably cost him that seat. So we did present it to Los Angeles City Council. And that was easy for them to do in 2020, because by mid 2020, by the summer of 2020, everyone was chanting Black Lives Matter. And we can say it was a racial reckoning, but it was specifically a Black Lives Matter uprising. And so in order to kind of appease that, many of these electeds were willing to hear us out. I think that the presentation that we gave that year was particularly compelling. It was given inside city council chambers. And so that was really important. By 2021, a backlash had begun, and we weren't invited by the full city council. We had to push to get Herb Wesson's successor, who we later found out or confirmed really was not a fan of Black people. Nuri Martinez was his successor. We had to push her to allow us into that space and to give a presentation. And then by 2022, it was only a very few elected officials or city council members who would hear our presentation. So people like Mike Bonin, who see themselves as allies, people like Marquise Harris Dawson were eager to receive that information. And then finally, when Karen Bass was elected mayor last year, we were able to give the people's budget presentation to the mayor, who actually, for the first time, the mayor of Los Angeles actually came to our hood and didn't just invite us to City Hall, but came to our home, which is called the Center for Black Power. It sits right in Africatown, which some people call Leimert Park, the birthplace of Black Lives Matter. She came there, and before a packed room of hundreds of mostly Black Angelenos, we gave the people's budget presentation to her. Unfortunately, when we gave that presentation, it was towards the end of the budget process. So even though she received the information, she'd already kind of gone along with what many advisors told her to. And in fact, she increased the police budget. This year, we've been invited to give her the results of the survey and the results of the entire people's budget process earlier. So we'll be giving that to her before a budget is actually presented. We'll give it to her in February and hope that it's considered as she builds the new budget or proposes the new budget. Hopefully she'll hear from us as loudly as she believes police interests are.
Melina, has the Los Angeles effort around participatory budgeting. How do you put that into a national context? Is LA further along than some other cities are? You know, we've seen sort of flashpoints, of course, in Minneapolis, but also in cities like Detroit and Oakland, where there have been efforts to defund the police, Seattle, et cetera. I'm not sure if any of those cities specifically use participatory budgeting processes, but how do you put LA's process in a national context?
Sure. So what we've been doing since 2020 is convening cities nationally around a people's budget process. We know we have people's budget processes from Santa Clara, California to Des Moines, Iowa. There are groups who are pushing a people's budget process. And so I think on our calls, we generally have between 30 and 50 cities represented who are replicating the people's budget work. And some actually predate our work in Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and have been doing some participatory budgeting work. We think it's gaining traction. People, no matter what their political stance, believe in the concept of democracy. Like, of course, this is our money. We should have a say-so in how it's spent. And so we're able to get lots of folks on board around that. In fact, what we see also is people, regardless of political persuasion, tend to lean towards defunding the police. Now, they don't like that term anymore. But people, when they see one of the things that prompted us to do this is a simple pie chart was presented to neighborhood councils in Los Angeles. And you could see in red that 54% of the city's general fund was going to police. And everybody from, the Howard Jarvis tax people? Everyone from the Howard Jarvis tax people to Black folks in South Central Los Angeles and Watts said, that's too much money for police. So we know that people know that we shouldn't be spending that kind of money on police that don't actually keep us safer. And that's true in Los Angeles. That's true in Oakland, where I know people like Kat Brooks and the Anti-Police Terror Project are working on issues like that and making sure that they also work towards defunding police there. That's true in Minneapolis, where Black Visions, which was a Black Lives Matter chapter, are working on issues like this. So there is a national context, and we see it moving because the most significant budget, especially when you're talking about things like police, comes from local tax dollars, which sometimes receives federal funds or always receives federal funds, but those decisions are made by municipalities. And so there is a national effort that's happening in at least 30 to 50 municipalities that we know of that have been part of these people's budget calls.
Now, this idea of reimagining public safety via the budgeting process, what would you like ideally to see happen as an abolitionist yourself? When we look at the results of the surveys, at least I saw one survey that people were happy to designate a mere 1.64% of the entire city's budget to police, which is quite remarkable. As an abolitionist, do you want to see, you know, something on that order or 0%?
I say zero. I say police, and we say police don't keep us safer. And I'll give you this. This is my theory, right? Which has never been proven wrong. There is no Black person on the face of this earth that has felt safer when a police cruiser pulls up behind them in traffic. Nobody goes, oh my goodness, I'm safer now, right? So when we think about that, we know intuitively as Black people, police don't keep us safe. Now, what we have to do a better job at is talking about alternative models. So the data also meets this out, right? Police don't come and prevent crime. Police might respond to a crime after it's happened. But even when you talk about the most egregious crimes, when we think about murder, right? Police are only successful in solving those crimes less than 2% of the time. So what is successful? If we think about Newark, New Jersey, where they've invested deeply in community safety programs, right? And I think about the phenomenal work of people like Akilah Shirills, who's from Watts, right? those have had triple the impact. They've been much, much more successful in making communities safer than has policing. And so it's really important that we understand that, in the words of one of my mentors and the most brilliant economist that I know, Dr. Julianne Malveaux, she says that budgets are moral and ethical documents, and they're zero-sum games. So that means if we spend almost $4 billion, or now it's upwards of $4 billion on police in the city of Los Angeles, that's $4 billion that could have housed everybody. That's $4 billion that could have provided health care, including mental health care for all. So we have to be willing to say, well, what do we want to take out of policing, these kind of oppressive forces, and what do we want to invest in the things that actually make us safe? So yes, my position is let's completely defund the police and let's fund heavily systems of public safety that are rooted in community. Why do we spend money here and not there? Why don't we have a bigger pot of money, right? How do we begin to question systems and vision new systems, right? And so I think participatory budgeting is one way of pulling masses of people into a process and engaging in ways that empower communities to radically vision and reimagine the world and work towards the world of our greatest hopes and dreams.
Melina, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Dr. Melina Abdullah, professor and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University of Los Angeles. She's active with the LA chapter of Black Lives Matter. And this interview is one of 12 interviews featured in my latest book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, with a foreword by Robin D.G. Kelly, out on January 14th, 2025 by Seven Stories Press. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Educator and food justice activist Leah Penniman, who runs Soul Fire Farm in upstate New York, calls herself an abolitionist. That is, someone who works to abolish policing and prisons. Yet, food justice, her main focus, may seem unrelated to abolition, but Penniman sees them as intimately linked. Leah Penniman is the author of the acclaimed book Farming While Black. In an interview for my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, she asks us to imagine restoring people's deep connections to land and growing our own food, and challenges us to ask the question, what if we decarcerated our people and our food simultaneously, relying on the life-giving possibilities of land stewardship, while rejecting the death-making institutions of policing and imprisonment? I'm so pleased today to share this conversation with you for the first time. It's one of 12 interviews featured in Talking About Abolition, published by Seven Stories Press this month. Welcome to the program, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this country has historically discriminated against Black farmers and disproportionately advantaged white farmers and white-run agricultural corporations. Why is connecting people to land, especially Black people to land, so important for you?
Well, as Malcolm X in Blessed Memory said, land is the basis of revolution, of justice, of freedom, of equality. And so in this country, land ownership, as you mentioned, is so skewed that 98% of the agricultural land value is in white hands. And this is not because Black and Brown folks aren't interested in farming. We have a waiting list around the block for our farmer training programs, and most of those farmers are landless. It's because of a history of genocidal violence against Indigenous people, of chattel slavery and all of its permutations, of sharecropping and convict leasing. It's because of our own government's discrimination against Black farmers, and now the land grabbing that's going on under the guise of corporate profit. And so we have a situation where land, which is not only the basis of freedom, it's the basis of cultural belonging, of intergenerational wealth, our capacity to feed ourselves, to build our homes, to have a place to bury our dead and family reunions together, is slipping away. And we came so close, you know, to being able to regain some of that through the Justice for Black Farmers Act and the efforts to reform the USDA. And the lawsuits that, you know, the lawsuits that white farmers brought to bear calling reverse racism have really slowed down those gains that were promised, you know, in 2020 to 2022. And we're not giving up, but it right now is really up to the grassroots. And we're seeing how much the connection to land, when it's rooted in dignity, when it's rooted in choice, not only allows people to think about a way of making a living that is right livelihood and support their community, but starts to heal that generational trauma and give folks a taste of a world that's possible, connected to our heritage, to the earth, and to our own dignity.
And so that's a perfect segue into asking about how you link abolition of police and prisons and the entire so-called criminal justice system, how you link the abolition of that system to food justice?
It's so important because a lot of folks, when they think about these systems of state violence, of police and prisons, don't understand how it's intersectional with other issues. And yet, one of the most powerful illustrations of this I saw was actually a GIS map overlay of the neighborhoods that were the most heavily policed, where there were the highest rates of incarceration in New York City, were the very same neighborhoods with low rates of Black homeownership, with lower educational quality, with lower access to fresh fruits and vegetables, essentially food apartheid neighborhoods. So it's not an accident of history that these very same zip codes that are criminalized and over-policed are the neighborhoods where people don't have access to fresh food, to clean water, to fresh air. These are the same neighborhoods where, you know, factories and waste sites are located. And it's because of a history of racialized discrimination. So I think that the beautiful thing about bringing abolition into the conversation is it forces us to widen our lens and ask, well, what are the underlying causes of these systemic racial oppressions? And we have to look at racial capitalism. We have to look at settler colonialism. We have to look at the ways that Black bodies have been seen as only useful for profit, including the profit of private prisons. And the way that, you know, land has been taken away and autonomy has been taken away from Black and Brown communities. So that's one lens. I think it allows us to get at root cause. And I think another way that I approach it is, to me, abolition speaks to this really beautiful and important yearning that we have for nonviolent liberation. We don't want in the long march to liberation to be replicating the kinds of structures of violence that cause the problems in the first place. We don't want to be policing one another. We don't want to be imposing our will on other humans or the earth in ways that are non-consensual. We don't want to have to use coercion and force in order to live. And when we look at the food system right now, it's very much based on violent coercion. It's based on the exploitation of farm workers who are often displaced from their homelands because of so-called free trade agreements or war, economic desperation, unfair immigration policy. We look at the way the land is treated under racial capitalism as nothing more than a natural resource to be extracted, and the violence on the climate and the waters. And so when we frame abolition as this yearning for nonviolent liberation, we also have to ask ourselves, you know, in our work, how do we embody democracy, consent, dignity, care, mutual care, loving kindness. And this is very inspiring to me and something that I see as a, you know, a really, really powerful impulse in the rising generation of farmers.
Can you tell me what you have seen happen when young folks, especially young people of color, young Black people, first experience farming in spaces like Soulfire Farm?
So it's been really powerful. My spouse and I came out here with our young children to this rocky mountain back in 2006 and expected to be quite alone. And we had resigned ourselves to that because we had bought into this myth that Black and brown folks were so traumatized by land-based oppression that there wasn't an interest in essentially stooping and returning to this undignified way of being on the land. So it was a shock to me as much as it was to anyone else when after we, you know, officially opened our farm in 2010 and started to get out there doing our youth programs and feeding the community with doorstep delivery, that the phone calls were coming in of folks who were interested in being trained. And this snowballed. I mean, one program turned into two, turned into eight, you know, 10 people coming through a year turned into 2,000. And something that has happened time and again, and I joke about this because my background is in environmental science, you know, biology, chemistry. And so I can do a pretty mean soil chemistry class with cation exchange capacity and binding sites and feel real good about that. But the thing that people are taking away, in addition to these hard skills and that they comment on so often, is this immense healing power that being in touch with the land, in community with other Black and brown folks, in a lineage where, you know, we're learning about the proud agrarian heritage, the contributions of folks like Dr. George Washington Carver to our understanding of cover cropping, or the contributions of Fannie Lou Hamer to our understanding of cooperatives and the role of food and liberation. And so folks are saying that this contact with the earth, this contact with heritage, is allowing them to wake up to a future they didn't imagine possible, allowing them to see beyond, you know, the harmful relationship they might be in, or the undignified job they might be in, or the narrative they might have bought that their only future is as a consumer, sort of a cog in this machine, to say, oh, you know, maybe it is possible to envision a livelihood, a way of being that is nourishing to both myself and community. And that's been so profound in its incessant consistency, this healing and this visioning and this opening up of possibility that the land gives us.
And so can you give me some examples or stories of people whose lives have been transformed in ways that they just didn't expect?
Sure. And I think that, you know, there's so many forces at play. So as Soulfire Farm, we don't want to take undue credit. I mean, folks, ancestors and communities and lineages are all at play, the land herself. But it's been amazing to see the alumni from our program take the seeds of what they learned here and plant them in the fertile soils of their homes. So I think of, you know, Karatumbo Cooperative in Chicago, this femme immigrant queer co-op that was growing food and feeding folks through the pandemic so beautifully that I admire them so much. Or the Shelterwood Collective in the Pacific Northwest that's doing this re-indigenizing forest management on hundreds of acres collectively and centering disability justice. There's folks, you know, in the Southeast outside of Georgia who are reclaiming at High Hog Farm, who are reclaiming Black folks' connection to fiber, which has been really severed after the trauma of cotton picking. And they are growing both plant and animal fibers and learning and teaching, you know, dyeing and spinning and weaving and bringing these arts back to life in their community, and so many more, you know. And so it's been, we like to think of the Soulfire Network as mycelial, where, you know, our job as one tree in the forest is to share our minerals and messages and sugars, you know, our resources, our knowledge through this fungal hyphae network to the other trees in this beautiful superorganism of the forest. And then they use those resources to express in their own unique way, their own locally adapted way, what it looks like to have, you know, a beautifully nonviolent, liberatory effort towards food and land justice.
You talked about racial capitalism earlier. How has that perverted and subverted our connection to food? And how do we completely transform that system of, you know, the corporatized system of food monopolies? How does that naturally go hand in hand with a world without prisons and police?
Oh, that's such a big question. So as you noted, the food system is essentially incarcerated, right, in corporate racial capitalism. And so our seed diversity has been decimated. The land is concentrated in the hands of a few, one racial group, and many of those landowners corporatized at this point. We have workers who are not protected under federal labor laws like the National Labor Relations Act or the Fair Labor Standards Act. We have consumers who are getting products that are devoid of the rich nutrients that those same crops once held because of their growth rate, because of the soils and that they're produced in, the they're overladen with chemicals transported far distances. And so, you know, there's a huge disconnect between what's on our plate and our own understanding and experience of nourishment. And so we see this this just epidemic of a reduced life expectancy, of diabetes, of heart disease, of kidney failure, and all of these illnesses, both of the body and also arguably of the spirit, that are connected to not having access to that life-giving food. So it's a really big problem. And I think the thing that gives me some hope amidst it is remembering that this, you know, incarceration of the food system, so to speak, is really only a few hundred years old in the long march of history. And so anything that humans can cook up, however harmful, within a few generations, certainly could be dismantled, you know, within hopefully several generations. And it will take policy. You know, right now we incentivize trashing the planet and human lives. You have to jump through hoops and get certified to be organic, but you can go ahead and feel free to, you know, decimate ecosystems without applying to do so, right? And so really thinking about what we're incentivizing in terms of policy. All fruits and vegetables are relegated to this tiny sliver of the USDA budget called specialty crops, even though they should be at least half of our diets, right? And so on that, on the one hand, and then when we look at land and workers, we're really advocating for wholesale land reform. I mean, returning land to Native folks, making land available to Black and Brown communities affordably so that we can not just be, you know, laborers on a corporate farm, but be in a position of management, of collective and cooperative ownership, and prioritizing what our communities most need. So we'll take political pressure, and it will also take, you know, good old grassroots alternative institution building. It was really beautiful in some ways to see in the pandemic the how well placed some of these small independent mutual aid networks and co-ops were to pivot and meet the needs of community when the corporatized infrastructure balked at, they were really unable to change at the rate that was needed in order to feed community. So it's this little glimmer of possibility of like, oh, this community created infrastructure actually is resilient, is flexible, adaptable, and can meet needs. So I hold on, you know, I hold on, even though clearly the trend has been to corporatize and to make the food system more violent in the West.
So if the incarceration of land is linked to the incarceration of people, then conversely, the decarceration of land and people need to go hand in hand.
Absolutely. You know, and quite literally, that nasty little loophole in the 13th Amendment that does allow slavery in the case where someone has committed a crime, you know, as defined by the courts these days, it means that predominantly Black folks who are incarcerated can be made to work for no pay. And we see this in, fighting the wildfires in California and the West. We see this during the pandemic with labor shortages in the fields of folks coming from prison and picking vegetables and, picking grains in order to keep the food system running. We see this with furniture companies and, all kinds of corporate entities taking advantage of this. And so freeing the lands, in the food system, it's metaphor, but it also quite literally, these systems are intertwined where the prison industrial complex is invested in a corporatized and violent food system.
Leah, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website that you'd like to recommend, any place that people can follow your work?
Well, thank you for having me. Folks can find out more at soulfirefarm.org or follow us on any of the social media platforms at soulfirefarm.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Leah Penniman is a farmer, author, and food justice activist based in upstate New York, where she runs Soulfire Farm. Her books include Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation of the Land, and Black Earth Wisdom, Soulful Conversations with Black Environmentalists. She's one of 12 abolitionists featured in my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, out in January 2025 by Seven Stories Press. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. How do we think about creating a world free from policing and prisons? A world where the constant fear of state violence is a thing of the past? We turn now to Gina Dent to help answer that question and to discuss how adopting an abolition mindset isn't just relegated to the criminal justice system. It means reimagining society as a whole, especially in how we think about our responsibilities to one another while balancing our individual rights. Gina Dent has spent years alongside the godmother of abolition, Angela Davis, in exploring how abolition ideals intersect with feminism and social justice movements. She co-directs the Visualizing Abolition Project at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she's a feminist studies professor. The project challenges narratives linking prisons to justice and imagines new ways of thinking about a prison-free future. She has also published a conversation with Angela Davis titled Prison as a Border and is co-author with Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie of the book Abolition Feminism. Now, I spoke with her last year as part of 12 interviews I did with leading abolitionists. It's part of my just published new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible. Here is Gina Dent.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
So when we talk about the conversations that entered into the national dialogue after 2020, during and after the racial reckoning, as some people call it, of 2020, there was a lot of lip service paid to the idea of abolition. Was that year for you a game changer, or have we since then as a society just returned to embracing policing and prisons as a quote unquote necessary part of society?
I don't know if I would say that moment was the game changer. I think really what preceded that moment, that made us ready for that moment, was the game changer. You know, it's the decades of work toward abolition. I'm specifically talking about prison abolition that really allowed us to take advantage of that moment, to be prepared for that moment, to know how to respond in that moment. The degree of sophistication that people had when they were asked about the viability of a society that operated without prisons and policing was really astonishing. I will say, however, that I think what did transform in that time period was a relationship, as I just mentioned, to policing rather than only imprisonment. The movement that I had been involved with previously was much more focused on the hidden aspects of our carceral system and less focused on things that were already being handled by a kind of another wing of the movement around stop and frisk or driving while black or the difference in the rates of arrest, the treatment after arrest, et cetera, all that kind of work that people have been doing for a very long time. But I think the way that abolition became an all-encompassing address to the carceral system was really new in that moment in some ways. And I think also we have continued to stay with that movement, though I know a lot of municipalities are struggling with the actual unrolling of new ways of organizing society, but I don't think we're done with that.
You have written about abolition, as you said, for many years, but you've also specifically written about abolition and feminism. You're a professor of feminist studies, and you wrote alongside Angela Davis, a book specifically focused on abolitionism and feminism, and that feminism cannot be attached to incarceration, that feminism has to be anti-racist and anti-capitalist. And I'm wondering if you can share that a little bit more with our audience in terms of how feminism needs to redefine itself in an abolitionist world or post-abolitionist world.
So I guess I would put it slightly differently. So that book, which is called Abolition Feminism Now, is a collaborative book project between myself, Angela Davis, as you mentioned, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie. And all of us had been involved in different ways in the abolitionist movement for a long time. We had known each other for a very long time in the movement, and we really saw the need to address what we used to address mostly in the hallways, between events or after events with each other, either the problem of the failure to address feminist issues in abolitionist contexts, or the problem of not thinking about abolition when doing feminist work, specifically against domestic violence and other forms of interpersonal violence. So that really doesn't mean that we have to wait for, or we can wait for abolition to then transform our feminism. It really means that it's a necessary component of both abolition and feminism. And so we treated abolition feminism as a compound noun. In other words, you can take one part out and do the abolition part, and then you can do the feminist part separately. We really believe and tried to strongly state the case that separating out those elements from that compound noun would do violence to our movements. And so, balancing the need to address state harm and interpersonal harm, and moving to a society that organizes us differently in relationship to each other and how we deal with harms between us, is important. And it's not something that can be thought about as an additive way of relating to the issue, or even something that we could address post facto.
There was a time when the term restorative justice was very trendy, and I'm wondering if that is still a relevant term or idea, in as much as we can even think about how we apply it to harm reduction or tackling harm in, with regard to interpersonal violence.
So, restorative justice is a term that I hear used sometimes interchangeably with other terms within the abolitionist movement. I live in Oakland, California. In Oakland, California, There is an organization called Restorative Justice for Oakland Youth that I've been affiliated with for a long time, and know I don't work with them, but I know of them, and I've been close to people who are involved in that work. And some part of that work would probably be what I would think of as abolitionist, and some part of that work might be in another area. I've heard people use the term restorative justice in so many contexts. So I would say that though it's not the term I generally use, I tend to use transformative justice. I even work in transitional justice frameworks that are more global. But I'm less concerned about the actual labels that people use when they're doing this kind of work. I'm more concerned with evaluating how much the organizations, the practices, the ways of relating are feeding the carceral system and how much they're moving us away from carcerality. I think sometimes restorative justice has been tricky in the sense that it has built itself upon cultural practices that are first maybe overly white, Quaker, not a Christian, and not necessarily embracing of all, and then increasingly moving toward more African diaspora centered practices and indigenous practices. And I think those things really work in communities where that cultural fabric is strong. But I think it's hard to move those same practices into every environment. So well, I find that people are using restorative justice as the name for practices that I would recognize more under the category of transitional justice or transformative justice. And really, I think that those of us in the abolitionist movement are less concerned with the labels, and we're much more concerned with what we're doing to build together.
So then how do we define these forms of justice, transitional or transformative justice? What, you know, I think a lot of people who identify with the tenets of abolition still feel like they need some concrete examples of what that could look like when harm is done. If we don't rely on policing, courts, and prisons, what do we rely on? And I know that, you know, there's so much more to be said in terms of how we reduce harm by funding the things that keep us safe to begin with. But of course, we can't necessarily completely eradicate when harm is done, mm-hmm. by fully funding all the things that we need. So what do the nuts and bolts of a new system look like?
Well, many people have argued in the movement that we have a lot of the nuts and bolts. It's not as if we're acting as if we're going to build the society completely new. We're trying to reinvigorate, revitalize those practices that are equitable, healing, and where our interpersonal relationships are not dependent on racial hierarchies, sexual hierarchies, gender hierarchies, other kinds of, certainly, of course, class, which is maybe the most important one to draw out. And so those ways of thinking deeply about societal inequities and reaching for a way of embracing all is fundamental to what it means to build toward abolition. So we have some of those practices, and people are actually doing this work in local spaces, and that's so exciting to see. A lot of that work is invisibilized by the media, and I think it's really important for those of us who are involved in these organizations and municipalities to keep telling the stories of what's happening around us. My work has been much more focused on national and international or transnational organizing, but I know that there are many people who are around me in Oakland who are working daily on these questions. And in the backlash to the turn toward abolition, there has really been an elimination of coverage of the stories that would allow us to be able to imagine how we would live together. no one, I don't know anyone in the abolitionist movement who is naive about harms or violence.
So on that, then following up, do you feel that we really need an important cultural mindset shift in this country away from this idea of punishment, which is a very individualist, racial capitalist approach to how society tackles actions of individuals? All actions are seen as the coming from individuals and from individual failings rather than from societal failings. So do we? I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on necessitating a cultural shift where we really start to embrace the idea of collective liberation, collective responsibility, collective, harm and restoring of people and society, just a complete mindset shift from what we're so immersed in right now, which is that everybody is just responsible for themselves.
Well, certainly. And I think that is ongoing. It's challenging under the conditions of racial capitalism to think toward that form of responsibility. It reminds me of a distinction that is sometimes hard to hold on to, but between what have been described as responsibility-based cultures and rights-based cultures. One of the most interesting sets of discussions that I tend to have, especially with young organizers, has to do with their sense of like their right to things, the right to be free from harm. And sometimes this comes up even in organizational conversations and struggles. And instead, trying to reorient us toward, what are our responsibilities toward each other? One way of kind of imagining what this might be like, we can, think about through the, metaphor of the mask these days, right? People who like won't wear a mask to prevent someone else from getting COVID. What does that mean about a culture that where people think that, it's their right to be mask-free versus it's their obligation, it's their responsibility to care for others, even if they themselves could be healthy without wearing a mask. It's not a perfect example, but I think the analogy allows us to see that we need to be much more responsibility-based in our way of understanding our lives. And we should be toward each other, imagining that we can interact in ways that where we know we are going to be supported, and we're also not so invested in building up our individual personal narratives.
I want to thank you so much, Gina Dent, for this wonderful conversation. Really appreciate your incredible insight.
Thank you. Thank you for doing the work.
My guest has been Dr. Gina Dent, who co-directs the Visualizing Abolition Project at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she's a feminist studies professor. She's the co-author with Angela Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie of the book Abolition Feminism Now. The transcript of this conversation is one of 12 interviews with abolitionists included in my new book, Talking About Abolition: A Police-Free World is Possible, just published by Seven Stories Press. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
Thank you. $10 might seem like a small amount, but when you sign up as a KPFK Sustainer Circle member, that $10 helps pay for daily broadcast of Democracy Now!, the Tom Hartman Program, and all of the news and information you hear on KPFK. You get a lot for your monthly contribution, and we need that gift right now to keep bringing you all of the programs you count on. $10 makes a big impact. We combine it with contributions from your fellow listeners who rely on KPFK as much as